Today's episode of the Accidental Creative Podcast is brought to you by FreshBooks. To see how FreshBooks can save you time and boost your creativity, go to freshbooks.com/accidental and enter accidental in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Hey everyone, welcome to the Accidental Creative Podcast. My name is Todd Henry. I am the founder of Accidental Creative and the author of a bunch of books, including The Accidental Creative, of course, and the new book, Herding Tigers, Be the Leader That Creative People Need, which is all about how to lead creative teams effectively and create an environment in which your creative process can thrive. And this show is about you. It's about your creative process. It's about how you go to work and bring yourself every day and how you stay prolific, brilliant, and healthy in the midst of the pressures that you face as a create on demand professional. On today's show, we're going to talk about the most difficult and crucial part of any long creative project, and that is, of course, the messy middle. There are all kinds of things that can take you off course in the midst of a project. And, you know, we often talk about starting and we often talk about finishing, but we don't talk about that messy middle because it's difficult, it's challenging, and every project is different. Well, on today's show, we have someone who's going to help us through that. His name is Scott Belsky. He's just written a book called The Messy Middle, and it's all about those weird and twisting and tumultuous things that happen between starting a project and finishing the project. And we're going to have a conversation about some of the pitfalls and some of the things we can do to get through, to navigate through the challenging and messy middle. Before we dive in, I want to let you know today's episode is brought to you by FreshBooks. So in my book, Herding Tigers, I talk about the five popular myths about creative people. And one of those myths is that creative people lack business acumen, which drives me crazy. It's so not true. The truth is creative people can be extremely business savvy. They just happen to solve problems slightly differently than many other people. Nobody understands this more than FreshBooks. And the proof is in the millions of creative pros who have turned to FreshBooks cloud accounting to help them conquer their admin and their paperwork. Oh, and by the way, I happen to be one of those creative pros. The first instant that we started using FreshBooks at Accidental Creative, I instantly understood why it's such a perfect fit for creative pros. The interface is visual, it's really intuitive, and it's ridiculously easy to use. Sending a professional branded invoice takes about 30 seconds. Setting yourself up to receive online payments takes just 2 clicks. And there's a proposals feature that means you can incorporate your project details, the scope of work, and a timeline as part of your estimate. So to get a feel for using FreshBooks, they're offering an unrestricted 30-day free trial to all listeners of the Accidental Creative Podcast. That means there's no credit card required, which is really, really rare, as you know. All you need to do is go to freshbooks.com/accidental and enter accidental in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's freshbooks.com/accidental and enter accidental in the How Did You Hear About Us section. We thank FreshBooks for sponsoring this episode of the Accidental Creative Podcast. Well, our guest today is Scott Belsky. Scott is the author of a new book called The Messy Middle, Finding Your Way Through the Hardest and Most Crucial Part of Any Bold Venture. And we're going to talk about a lot more. Scott, welcome to the Accidental Creative Podcast.
Thanks, Todd. Great to be here.
So a lot of people know you as the co-founder of Behance. I know we've had you on the show before, but could you just catch us up on what you've been doing for the last several years?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a journey, a volatile one at times, but Behance was a 5-year bootstrapped venture, started out as a lifestyle business, then grew into after 5 years, a venture-backed business for 2 more years, and then we were acquired by Adobe. So I navigated the process of bringing a small team into a big company and, you know, getting it rooted and figuring out all the challenges. Had an incredible 3 years at Adobe. Then I left and became a full-time investor, which was another major career shift that also involved me recognizing that I missed building teams and building product and wanting to get back into it. So while I continue to invest as a seed investor and advisor, I've now jumped back into a new role back at Adobe as chief product officer. And so I feel like now if I look back at the line of, you know, gosh, you know, startup that is super bootstrapped, barely making payroll, venture-backed, post-acquisition, big company, investor, solo operator, back to a big company executive. It's been a volatile one.
Well, you've seen the entire spectrum of experience, right? For creative pros. I mean, you've sort of been at every possible stage and had to deal with all of those dynamics. And it really comes across in this new book, The Messy Middle. I know I told you this before we started recording, but this is one of my favorite business books of the last 10 years. I mean, it just, I thought it was, it's humble, it's smart. I think you treat readers like adults, which is so rare. I mean, surprisingly, but it's very rare that readers are treated like adults. Like, I'm going to let you make some connections here. I'm not going to try to spoon feed everything to you, which I loved. And you were really vulnerable in this book, which I loved as well, because I think the best insights often come from really sort of, you know, cutting yourself open and saying, okay, here we go. Let's talk about all the messy parts of this. And the book covers a lot of really important ground. I mean, we love to talk about the start. We love to talk about the finish. I mean, those are really popular topics, right? But very few people have addressed the messy middle. Why did you specifically, Scott, put yourself through the torture of writing about the messy middle? Because this could not have been an easy process.
Right. Why would I want to write about the part that everyone wants to forget?
That's right.
including myself. And that actually is how I started my own journey, through synthesizing a lot of these little, you know, notes from board meetings and experiences and trying to weave it into a narrative as I went through my own kind of pictures, actually photos on my iPhone back for like the 5 years of bootstrapping, and went to the middle of Behance and tried to remember what it was that I actually was doing, because I kind of forgot many of these so-called lost years of my own journey. Mm. And I realized that it all kind of comes down to two things in my mind. It's endurance and it's optimization. So it's enduring the lows, all those points where there's complete ambiguity, anonymity, uncertainty, really not sure kind of what to do next, trying to keep the team together, trying to keep people motivated. And how do you kind of withstand those periods without any short-term rewards that keep you going? And then there's the peaks, right? And anything that actually starts to work and gain traction and get exciting, it's wondering, wait, what the heck just happened? How do we do more of that? Whether it's in something that is working with the product, how the team's working. And so I just tried to start to chronicle the insights or muscle memory from my own experience, but also just going to tons of different entrepreneurs, artists, writers, and asking them about their kind of lows and highs and how they manage both.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you argue in the book is that the middle is about enduring and optimizing. And one of the sort of head scratching quotes at first, I had to stop and think about this, that you write about early in the book. You say that volatility is good for velocity. What does that mean?
Well, when you have lows, there's something to mine in those lows that you can then leverage to make the next low less low, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And it kind of comes down to the self-mortem, and self-awareness that is generated from those moments. And if you think about, if there is some correlation between going to, sort of the old saying that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, is very much true. I really do believe that teams and individuals that go through very great hardships and actually are able to synthesize what it was that made it happen and learn from it, you know, their peaks are incrementally higher. And I try to just capture that in the book through some of the stories and insights. But the question, of course, is how do you not like fall out of the low? You know, how do you make sure you recover and garner some velocity from it? But I certainly think that, you know, this is the rhythm of making. It's actually being able to go into the low, knowing why you're there, knowing you'll get out of it, and always kind of always taking something into your toolkit from each of those experiences.
Yeah, you wrote about this, and I think it was in Making Ideas Happen, you wrote about the project plateau, and I've shared this with people so many times and said this is a brilliant insight that Scott wrote about. But I think in some ways it sort of correlates to this idea of volatility, that we get to these hard moments and we think, oh, if it's hard, it must not be right. Or if it's hard, we must be going the wrong direction. And the reality is often you have to walk through the hardship to get to the good stuff. And a lot of people quit in the messy middle because it gets hard, but that's right when it's starting to get good.
Right. And I think, you know, the question I often get from entrepreneurs or anyone starting a bold creative project is, how do you know when to quit? And how do you know when to keep going? And my answer is, It's actually pretty simple, because despite how hard it may be and how hopeless you may feel, if you still have as much, if not more, conviction in the way you feel the world should be, if even though it's you're not even sure you're going to survive, you still believe that that independent professionals belong in a network in the 21st century, and you're building a network for independent professionals, or whatever it is that you believe the world will be, if your conviction is greater, you have to stick with it. However, what oftentimes happens is people realize, you know what? I actually don't really know if that's actually the way the world's going to be. And what I've learned from building empathy with customers and trying this and trying it again is my conviction starting to waver. Quit it. Like, do something different. You know, why do we stick through things just because we feel winners never quit? I mean, that doesn't make sense to me either.
Right. Well, and it's I think sometimes it's a matter of pride, right? I don't want to admit that I was wrong. And in order to produce great work, you have to be humble. You simply do. You know, and we talk a lot about sort of the ego-driven organization, and we talk about, you know, resolve and persistence. But the reality is that you have to be, without some degree of humility and a willingness to recognize things for what they are, it's going to be difficult to make progress. And you write about this also in the book. You say, you don't seek positive feedback or celebrate fake wins at the expense of hard truths. Yes. And I think sometimes when we are, you know, when our reputation is on the line, right? When we feel some degree of ego is involved in the project, it's really difficult to seek hard truths. And instead we try to backward rationalize. Why do you think this is so important to avoid?
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned this, because this is actually one of the parts, and there are many, that I try to actually bring up some contradictions that we have to reconcile on our own as leaders. So you actually do kind of have to celebrate things as wins in the journey when there aren't any customers yet, when you haven't really created anything yet. I do believe you have to short circuit the reward system so that the team or you feel like you're making progress, even though you may not have made any, you know, public progress yet. Yeah. Because that sense of progress is important. However, to your point, I delineate that from fake wins. And what I mean by that is, let's say you pay for some PR or paid article, or you enter some awards where if you pay, you win the award. And then you send it around to the team celebrating, oh, look at this paid promotional post, or look at the fact that we won this award we paid for. And the reason why that's bad is it is that false sense of confidence and security when we actually have to be facing the truth. And the way I discern between those two things is it's okay to manufacture wins that that get people to keep doing things that they need to keep doing to win ultimately.
Yeah.
However, it's not good to make up wins that kind of reward bad behaviors and make us think that we're actually doing things that we shouldn't be doing. And so that's like one of those responsibilities of the leader in managing the narrative and being the steward of perspective of the journey.
Yeah. And that's really, it's so easy to slip into that. It's so easy to want to, you know, it's the old story of the person shooting the arrow, then painting the target around the arrow, right? After they shoot the arrow, it's like, oh, wow, you're such a great archer. No, actually we backward rationalized that decision or that project. And it's so easy to do that, especially when you're trying to protect your reputation. And you have to be committed to something beyond that if you want to avoid those pitfalls, for sure.
Absolutely.
So this also plays into something else you write about in the book, which is the importance of self-awareness. And you say the only sustainable competitive advantage in business is self-awareness. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you think about it, it's interesting. Like I think that, and this is not in the book, but I'll just share from what was in my mind right now. But if I think about my own kind of weaknesses or weak points throughout my own kind of business journey, it's really at times where I was at my best, where things were going the best or the worst. At the best, I started to think, oh, we must have figured it out. And you have that kind of false attribution sense of, oh, everything that I've done must have been right because I'm winning. The other competition doesn't matter because we figured it out. When in fact, of course, you always have to be paranoid. And you have to recognize that a lot of the things that work are also due to timing and other factors out of your control. So there is that sense of self-awareness when things are going the best, which is actually we're missing something. that healthy paranoia. And then when things are going the worst, you actually start to make decisions out of fear.
Yes.
And similarly, you need that level of self-awareness to say, hey, actually, the reason I am reacting or overreacting to this competitor or to this market dynamic or the change in the economy or whatever went wrong is actually because I'm afraid that I'm screwing up or I'm losing. And so it's interesting that it's almost like this. I always believe that in some weird way, society in every industry pushes everyone to regress to the mean. Like everyone, you know, there's these natural forces on both the highs and the lows that push you back to the mean. And the only way to really defy that and kind of stay at your best, of course, is through that self-awareness. And it's not just about what's going on in your industry and with your peers. It's also like, you know, what am I missing right now? I think is something that I'm always trying to ask.
Yeah, well, and that plays into another thing you wrote about in the book, which is that playing the long game requires moves that don't map to traditional measures of productivity, right? And sometimes what the industry is pushing you toward or expecting from you are the traditional measures of productivity or success or whatever, however you want to define that, aren't necessarily the measures you need to be using if you want to accomplish something that no one can even see yet. No one is even expecting yet, right? So what are some ways that we can avoid that trap to regress to the mean, the trap of feeling pressured to just sort of conform to whatever is expected from us in terms of measures and industry standards?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, and I'm thinking now about some of the greatest leaders that I've seen do this well. I mean, I think one that I talk about quite a bit in the book is Ben Silbermann, the co-founder and CEO of Pinterest, who from the very beginning of this company has been underrated and heads down and is actually quite a great steward of the journey the company has gone through, where everyone could be focused on whatever metric of the month, you know, everyone else is talking about. And the press, of course, is always measuring the success of companies from very arbitrary numbers that they have access to. And as a result, CEOs like Ben might be seduced to optimize towards those measures because that's what the public is celebrating, whether it's traffic on site or unique users per month or whatever it is. Ben, on the other hand, really would split up the entire journey for his team into chapters. And he would say, this is the year of going global. This is the year of monetization. This is the year of this, the year of that. And then those chapter rallying cries would then have a few discrete measures associated with them that would in some ways help the team disconnect from whatever else the technology world was buzzing about. And he actually talks to me and I talk about in the book how he says he comes from a family of doctors where you go through 7 years of training just to get your license and actually start on your own. Right. And how he's now in an industry where 7 years is like a lifetime in the technology world. But his attitude is, why can't I do it the right way? Why can't we take our time and actually get it right? Why do we everything has to be a lean startup approach? And I think it's a very good contrarian perspective.
I love that. That's so good. And I think, you know, part of this, I think, is being willing to say, I'm not going to play everyone else's game, right? I get to choose the game that I want to play. I'm not going to be tricked or trapped into playing the game that somebody else wants me to play. And I think if we're wise enough and self-aware enough, to your other point, to be able to step back and choose the games that we play, I think it goes a long way toward helping us build a body of work that matters. And that ultimately we'll be proud of, regardless of what everybody else thinks, we will be proud of the body of work that we build in the end.
Yep. And you know, and that is, I think, maybe we'll talk a little bit towards the end of this podcast about the end, but because I do think about a lot the final mile as well. But it is about building that body of work that that you want associated with you and that can keep you engaged it's funny, like I don't believe that that people who do things they don't love are successful. It's actually, I've seen very few examples. You have to be passionate about it. You have to have this kind of insane level of curiosity that, again, allows you to dedicate to a long-term pursuit where the short-term rewards are void. And there's very few ways of ultimately tricking that.
Well, how do you, this is maybe an unfair question, but how do you begin to discern those things that are worth working on and those things that maybe you're working on only because others are expecting you to work on them?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think, you know, and I've fallen in that trap myself, you know, where people tell you, oh, you should do this, you should do this. And right. you realize that's not what I'm actually ultimately meant to do. I mean, to me, it comes down to this different question, this sensation of feeling fully utilized and what yeah. makes you feel that way. Because, you know, we can all be busy all day, every day doing something. And regardless of how much money we may be paid for doing that something, and, you know, and listen, like some of these are luxury problems, but the question is, can you find something in your life that you feel fully utilizes you, where mm-hmm. you feel at the end of the day spent in a very gratifying way? It's like, oh my goodness, what I went through today scraped the caverns of what I'm even capable of. Right. And that is like such a great feeling because first of all, you're being stretched, you're adding some unique value to the world in whatever it is you do. And I think that's like what our quest is to find what makes us feel fully utilized. And yeah. and coming from someone who has done things that made them feel fully utilized and didn't, and you know, in juxtaposing, you know, the contrast between the two, I'll tell you, like, nothing's better than that feeling of utilization.
Well, and sometimes the, you know, we try to seek that from our job all the time. And sometimes you have to recognize my job will never be able to fulfill me to the utmost, that I need to find something else in my portfolio, whether that's, you know, service or whether that's, you know, maybe a side project or something, some other way of finding creative expression. Because I think we unfairly sometimes expect our job to do things for us that our job is never designed to do.
It's a great point. And I think as you say that, Todd, I'm thinking, gosh, it's almost like a, you know, it's like cooking a great meal where it's the spices and the right ingredients in the right proportion that makes it all come together. And so perhaps utilization is a, you know, a unique mix of a certain number of things. I mean, listen, when I'm, you know, jumping around the room with my kids on on a Sunday, that is a part of me feeling fully utilized as well. You know, yeah. there's actually a creative side of me that doesn't necessarily come out in boardrooms and meetings, that gets to come out with my family. And, you know, and looking back at a week, I'm like, oh, you know, this was a great week because I did all of these different things in these proportions. And maybe yeah. that's what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for doing the hard work, walking through the messy middle and writing the messy middle. The book's called The Messy Middle, Finding Your Way Through the Hardest and Most Crucial Part of Any Bold Venture. The author is Scott Belsky. Scott, thanks so much for taking your time to be with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Really a pleasure.
And as always, thank you for listening. If you like this episode, make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Remember, friends, cover bands don't change the world. Don't be a cover band. You need to find your unique voice if you want to thrive. We'll see you next time.